I would like to talk about Indian science fiction because I never heard anything about it. Could you paint a picture of the world of Indian science fiction for us?
Thank you for asking that. That's actually been the focus of a lot of my research. Indian SF or Kalpavigyan or future fiction, more specifically, or fiction that deals with the future. Not all fiction that deals with the future is science fiction. And this kind of literature has been written for a very long time in India. There are people who go back to the ancient epics and things like that, and you have concepts like time dilation, etc., going on in ancient epics, ancient Indian epics. But to completely like take that out of the equation and say, well, okay, let's just look at, the last 100 years, then we have seen a lot of science fiction from India. It would fall in all kinds of genres, including very hard, scientifically accurate kind of future fictions. It can also fall in the very loose kind of fantasy, like wish fulfillment of possible futures. If we are to talk about just those 100 years, then I would say that we can't really use the term Indian SF, really. We can refer to many different vernacular or many different languages of India. So we have science fiction across many different languages. We have it in Bangla, which is what I work on. We have it in Hindi. We have it in Marathi. We have it in Tamil, Telugu, Malayalam. We have it in Uriya. So we have it in all our languages, pretty much. So the real question is, when we talk about Indian science fiction, what really are we talking about? Are we talking about specific traditions with those languages, or are we talking about something pan-Indian? And I think the notion of pan-Indian has more or less developed, I would say, from the 1980s, 90s onwards, primarily with Indian writing in English and science fiction that is written in English. Because these authors of these fictions can come from any region in India, but they're using English in order to speak to the global market of science fiction as well. As well as reach across different linguistic boundaries within the country. This kind of science fiction is a very elite phenomenon. It has readers, but it is by and large an elite phenomenon because most of the country would be interested only in reading science fiction in their own language. We have seen a lot of these, and I think some of the efforts that we have made so far in recent years have been in the field of translation, translating from these different languages into each other, between these languages or into English. That's what the state of it is right now. We have a lot of it. How much of it is accessible to people who don't speak those different languages? Unfortunately, we can't say. My research shows that there is an incredible lot, but we can only access very little small bits of it. The word is Kalpavigyan. So Kalpavigyan, literally, if you do the etymological unpacking of this word, it's actually very rich. So gyan means knowledge of all kinds. Vigyan is a specialized form of knowledge which relates to the material world. So gyan can include things like transcendental knowledge as well. So it is all kinds of knowledge. Vigyan is very specialized, diminutive form of knowledge. Kalpa, on the other hand, is a unit of time. It is really the largest unit of time that we have in Hindu, Buddhist, Jain, and Dharmic cosmology in general. So what Kalpavigyan, like quite literally means, is it refers to the transformation of knowledge across time, which is a very complex word, I believe, for what we would normally call science fiction in the Anglophone world. But Kalpavigyan is a richer word, and it also is a more expansive word than just science fiction, because it would also include science fantasy. It would also include something like horror or supernatural or uncanny. So it is closer actually to what is known as fantastica rather than to science fiction, the Anglophone description of science fiction anyway.
Geoengineering. When I see this word, I'm always thinking of Futurama when the climate change came and they threw like those ice cubes into the sea to slow it down. And I think I read it on the page of the Kalpana Collective, the role that science fiction and future fiction can play in the development of possible sustainable futures. Is geoengineering a possible way? Is science a way to make a better future and to slow down the climate change?
Geoengineering within the world of science fiction, the word that is often used is terraforming as well. Generally, the model is that you kind of go outwards, you know, onto some other planet, and then you terraform it or transform it into a habitable environment for humans. With geoengineering, is that a solution? Can that be a solution? Let's look at it this way. Let's look at it from the perspective of different species that we have on the planet itself. When we talk about ants or termites, they have been transforming or geoengineering habitats for a very long time. Some of these species have been doing that longer than humans. It really depends on how we define geoengineering. But can that provide solutions? Oh, absolutely. We have certain scientific disciplines right now. For instance, there is a lot of research into biomimicry. That is, we learn from different organisms, different plants, and the way they deal with the atmosphere, they deal with the soil, they deal with pollutants. Fungi, for instance, are a great example of this, because you can have fungi growing in extremely radioactive environments, environments that are hostile to humans. You have species like tardigrades, which can survive in deep space and, you know, under a lot of pressure deep inside the planet. So you have a lot of these species. You have flies, for instance, which have perhaps one of the best flying systems known to us. They can change their direction mid-air and things like that. And biomimicry is one of those disciplines where we are trying to learn from these species, and we are trying to learn what they do to the environment and how they deal with the environment, and then apply those principles backwards in our own daily lives and see, well, can we use some of these things that these species do in solving the planetary crisis or challenges of our time? So it is actually happening. A lot of science fiction does show the way, in the sense that science fiction has been dealing with the possibilities of transformation of environments and habitats for a very long time. I will heartily recommend my friend Chris Park's book on terraforming. The book is called Terraforming. It's by Chris Park. He studied this phenomenon in great detail in this book. It's from 2-3 years ago. So yes, it can provide solutions. And a lot of scientific organizations are actually doing that. They're learning from other species. They're learning from geoengineering movements, or if one wants to call it that, carried out by other species on this planet.
How do postcolonial studies and science fiction research match?
Traditionally, or the way we define, or the way we come to understand science fiction, has been very, very Anglophone, with some notable exceptions. So you have some French SF, some German SF, some Soviet SF, and things like that being researched. But by and large, the production that is carried out in large parts of the world is quite safely ignored within what we would call genre fiction studies. Within at least the last 2-3 decades, there have been a lot of new movements, which I wouldn't call completely science fiction, but which deal with the future very specifically, which have aligned themselves with some of the goals, I would say, of post-colonial studies, or I would say anti-colonial or decolonial studies, in order to imagine a future for all people on this planet. And the link between science fiction and colonialism has been explored at great length by many different critics who have employed the framework for post-colonial theory, such as John Reeder. His 2008 book, Colonialism and the Emergence of Science Fiction, tracks that very clearly. So what these new movements are doing is that they are, I believe, taking a decolonial stance or anti-colonial stance towards the genre itself, towards science fiction itself, and imagining futures that break from the genre shell of science fiction. Afrofuturism has been the pioneer for this. But you have indigenous futurism, term coined by Grace Dillon. You have Latinx or Latinat futurisms or Chicano futurisms, all of which in different ways represent the experience of South American and Latin people in the world. And you have the Chinese SF currently, which is very much in vogue, which has risen astronomically in the last decade or so. Sino-futurism, you have Indian SF. So a lot of these movements are aligned in their decolonial or anti-colonial goals to break science fiction from its genre shell of the Anglophone world and take it outwards. By and large, I think we have been successful, or we have seen this as a successful movement, which is really heartening.
As you mentioned Afrofuturism, well, the suggestion is the apocalypse has already happened and we're in the post-apocalyptic scenery, right?
That's something that I would take issue with. There is, of course, an understanding that a lot of what we would call the apocalypse or the apocalypse to come has already happened for Black and brown people all over the planet, really, with the era of colonialism. I would also mention a very, very powerful book that came out, I think, last year or the year before by Nick Estes called Our History is the Future. And it talks about indigenous movements in North America and the American continent in general, which talks about the genocide and the decimation of indigenous populations in America and connects that to the understanding of resistance for possible futures and so on. So it is actually a very hopeful book, even though it sounds quite otherwise from my brief description of it. It foregrounds the struggle. It foregrounds the efforts to build a better future in spite of all the violence and all the genocide and all the attempts to wipe other histories and other people and people's histories from the planet. So to a certain extent, then I do see the point that you're raising, that the apocalypse has already happened and we are in the post-apocalypse. But I think that this is fundamentally a question of where one stands. For a lot of fiction, I want to use climate fiction here as an example and environmental fiction as an example, quite simply because climate fiction consistently imagines a climate apocalypse, right? And I would list something like, I don't know, Margaret Atwood, for instance, as kind of a prime exemplar of this kind of narrative of collapse and chaos that is to come. Now, the issue with all of that is that it places questions of apocalypse and questions of climate change and climate disasters in the future, right? And the question would be that, okay, but you know, we are entering this, you know, era of the sixth extinction and so on and so forth. But if you go back in time and you see that, well, okay, since pretty much the beginning of what some people would call the Anthropocene, we have been wiping out species slowly. So in that sense, it has already happened. Many animals, many insect species have already died out. It, however, does not offer us any strategy for the future. What are we going to do to survive? What are we going to do to live past all of this? I think, to a great extent, science fiction from the global south or from Afrofuturism or indigenous futurisms or any of these strategies that I spoke about, they are trying to imagine a future which is not post-apocalyptic, but which is, I think, non-apocalyptic. Trying to imagine a future that is actually a possible positive future rather than just imagining a doom and gloom scenario. Because doom and gloom scenario is what we live with. Doom and gloom scenario is what most of the world, which has no resources, lives with. That's their everyday reality. To write a dystopia for them is just boring. It doesn't offer anything. It's everyday reality. So what do you do? So one way would be to imagine something else. And Octavia Butler, who is often cited as one of the founder figures for Afrofuturism in many ways, Octavia Butler and Samuel Delany, I would read some of their works more closely to argue what kind of possible futures we can imagine. Because these are not empty wish fulfillment. They are born out of a complete awareness of the struggles and the violence that people of color and people around the world face, disadvantaged people around the world face, and then imagining something else.
As I went to the exposition in Desert Times, the question was, why do we seek new worlds in science fiction? Like what I know is Dune, it's quite famous, the film by David Lynch, as we are heading towards our own desert. Is that a paradox or does it go hand in hand?
I mean, Dune is kind of like this classic example, right? I mean, at least I would say the first three books are really good. Let's forget about the existence of the rest of the series in there. But Dune is kind of interesting because Dune is playing out very much with the desert fantasy. It is playing out the whole notion of spice, you know, and the spice must flow and spice trade and so on. Is actually oil, is actually Middle East. There's a lot of geopolitics that is wrapped into that shell of a series. Are we heading towards the Dune universe? I think that like a lot of good science fiction, even politically problematic good science fiction, I think a lot of it offers interesting lenses from which to see the world. I think we are pretty much heading into many different deserts of our own. Desert in many ways is the future of the planet. It's like the ultimate future, as I call it. But the desert by itself, you know, our understanding of the desert is that it is this harsh environment, but people have lived in the deserts for a very long time. They have been living in deserts for a very long time, and they have consistently created different ways of adapting and living in. Deserts are teeming with life. What Dune does show is it really is about the Tuareg people, but the kind of technologies, for instance, the desert people use, such as the steel suits. Now, I think the steel suits are a fantastic innovation that are imagined in the Dune universe. But if we look at and if we learn from the species and the cultures and the communities that already live in the desert, then we might be able to identify even more strategies for the future, because desertification is real. Most big cities of India, for instance, are running out of water. They will run out of groundwater by 2030. We already have places like Arizona and parts of California and so on, which are extremely dry, and xeriscape or water management in these areas is already highly developed. We need to work more with these technologies. And science fiction does offer us interesting ways and interesting lenses. A steel suit is a very good innovation that I think Dune deals with. I would recommend reading that book anyway. I mean, I love that book. Problematic it is, but I love it.